أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على خير خلقه وخاتم أنبيائه ورسله سيدنا وشفيعنا بالقاسم محمد وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المنتجبين رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي امري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقهوا قولي اما بعد فقد قال سبحانه وتعالى في كتابه المجيد وهو اصدق القائلين بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم يا ايها الناس انا خلقناكم من ذكر وانثى وجعلناكم شعوبا وقبائل لتعارفوا ان اكرمكم عند الله اتقاكم ان الله عليم خبير صلوات In the name of God, the infinitely kind, the most merciful, those of us who have arrived here in one piece, you have braved the storm. You know, this is not substantial amount of snow. Thank you. When you compare to other countries, but anyways, I guess in London everything comes to a standstill. I'm very delighted those who came are here, and we'll continue our theme, the theme of how to find that point of balance, or at least the vicinity of point balance and moderation. We know that Imam Hussein gave an open invitation to us on the day of Ashura when all the martyrs had given up their lives. Imam Hussein gave a universal appeal to all of humanity that's current in perpetuity, in which he said, you all know, هَلْ مِنْ نَاصِرٍ يَنْصُرُنَا هَلْ مِنْ مُغِيثٍ يُغِيثُنَا Is there anyone to come and support me in my cause? Is there anybody who can render assistance and help in his cause for justice, in his cause for equity, fairness, in his cause for moderation, to remove any kind of hate, any kind of animosity, any kind of ill will? Imam Hussein was seeking for that kind of a culture. We said the culture the Quran calls ta'arufu, the culture of mutual recognition, the culture of mutual appreciation, the culture of peaceful coexistence as equal citizens under the umbrella of God. The concept of citizenship under God, in which we are all equal. Not just equal in the sight of what we say, the United Kingdom's, I don't know, rules or the United Nations rules. Citizenship under the umbrella of God, we are all equal. The Quran says, you know, we made into different nations and tribes, but that doesn't give you any kind of superiority. The distinctive mark of a human being is his actions, his mode of conduct, his behavior. And Karbala for us remains our criterion, our compass, and we measure ourselves in accordance with him. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Let me share with you the hadith that we have on this issue of love. The centrality and the pivot of love. We have a hadith that you may have heard. It says, Man mata ala hubbi ala Muhammad, mata shahida. One who dies with the sense of love in his heart, he dies the death of a martyr. Remarkable. If you die with love in your heart, with affection, with a sense of affinity and compassion and grace, you die as if, the Imam says, as a martyr. Man mata ala hubbi ali Muhammad, mata maghfura. One who dies with love that permeates in his heart for the family of the Prophet, the love in the sense of following the exemplar, of course, the love in the sense of learning to live like them and behave like them, learning to create cultures of peace. If you die with that kind of prevalence of love, the Imam says you died the death of somebody who has been forgiven. Man mata ala hubbi ali Muhammad, mata ta'iba. A person who dies with this love dies forgiven, his repentance has been accepted. And the hadith goes further. One who dies with this love, says the Imam, mata mu'minan mustakmil al-iman. He dies with iman that has attained completion and perfection. You see? It's love. Nothing about here, you know, is showing anger or showing your frustration or showing your animosity or revulsion. A person who dies with love and leaves this earthly abode with love, the Imam said it's a sign of perfection of his iman. Man mata hubbi ala ali Muhammad basharahu malak al-maut bil jannah. The angels are giving him tidings and news that paradise will be yours. And so on. It moves on further. Just to give you a glimpse that the Imam is seeking for us to show that kind of affinity, that kind of love. And lastly, when he wrote this letter to the people of Kufa, they wrote to him multiple letters of invitation. They said, come to us. We now have this governor, Nu'man bin Bashir, that we are prepared to overthrow him if you come there. The Imam sent only one letter in response to all these tons of letters that came. Some of these letters were written by tens of people. They were signed by tens of people. And that's why Muslim Ibn Aqil, when he arrived in Kufa, he was able to receive 18,000 pledges of allegiance very quickly. He was able to lead prayers. So Imam Hussein received many, many letters signed by multiple individuals. And when he was stopped, by Hur, the Imam showed, he had two sacks of letters that he showed them. That it's the same people that you are now fighting against me. You invited me. In this letter, the Imam says something very interesting. He says, I'm sending to you, you all know this, I'm sending to you my cousin, right? Wabni Ammi, my Akhi, my brother and my cousin, min Ahl Bayti. Ahl Bayti is used in different contexts. From my family, but not the Ahlul Bayt the way we understand as the infallible ones. I'm sending him to do investigation about the status in Kufa. And if it is what you have been reporting to me in your letters and what the messengers have been saying, your messengers have been telling me, then I'm going to come to you. That means a two-way. The Imam is saying that if I see the state of preparedness, the state of preparation, your readiness on that side, he says in very interesting word, he says, فَإِنِّي أَقْدِمُ إِلَيْكُمْ وَشِيكَ inshaAllah. In that case, if I see that there is a state of imminent preparation that is available on the other side, I will come to you momentarily, in a very short amount of time, imminently I'm coming, وَشِيكَ. Very rapidly I'm coming. On a condition, the condition was a contingent, it's based on a contingency. The condition was that if the landscape of the people of Kufa is prepared, not in terms of just giving letters of signatures, but prepared in terms of really receiving him in terms of conviction, the Imam says, I will come to you, washika. It's a lesson for us. Many a times you pray for the Imam Sahibul Zaman, Ajalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif, and we say to the Imam, we pray for the quick return. We ask God to expedite his... It's a common prayer for us. Isn't it true? In a Shia gathering, it's very common to pray and say, وَعَجِّلْ فَرَجَهُمْ. To pray for his quick return. But the return is conditional. God has appointed Imam Sahibul Zaman, so God has performed his function. We have somebody who is supposed to redeem us. Imam Sahibul Zaman is alive, so that role has been fulfilled and he's prepared to come. So from that side, that role is also fulfilled. But it's a three-way agreement. God has fulfilled his promise. Imam al-Mahdi is prepared to return to us and begin the inauguration of justice and equity. There's only a third factor remaining, then that is us. You see? In this chain to be connected and for this to find fruition, to crystallize into his reappearance, we are the missing link. Do you agree? The missing link is the humankind. Whenever the humankind shows that sense of preparation, that they are prepared to receive the Imam. That's exactly when the hadith says the Imam will be prepared to start a process of what you call this process of inaugurating peace, harmony, and love. So this is the three-way formula that we have. For example, we have some hadith which says the number of people required is only 313. It's very few numbers. Don't you think that in 1.4 billion we can find at least 300 or 400 people? Now, even if the hadith is just symbolic, even if the number doesn't mean exactly, because numbers are used sometimes symbolically to mean that even if there's a few number of people, doesn't mean exactly 313, assuming the hadith is true. But even then, it shows that when there is a group of people prepared to receive him, inshallah wa ta'ala, he will come. Now, this prayer can be misread by those who don't know the Shia ethos. If you read this dua of Imam Sahib al-Zaman and say, Allahumma wa ajjil farajahum, it can be misunderstood and misconstrued. Don't you agree? Because the Western audience doesn't understand the phenomena that we understand of the Messiah or the reappearance of the Mahdi. They think that you are creating what they call an apocalyptic vision. You are praying for apocalypse. You know, tongue twisters, you know. Because I have to transfer from Persian and Arabic and English and everything gets twisted, you know, in the process. You get confused. But when you render this kind of a prayer, for the audience, they think that you are praying for some kind of a great battle between good and evil, of destruction. You want to prepare destruction of humanity. And therefore, 2-3 years ago, a reporter from the Washington Post called me and he said, what do you have to say about the speech given by the President of Iran, Mr. Ahmadinejad, in which he begins his session with a prayer for Imam Sahib al-Zaman? Nothing new for us, it's very normal. But for them, they were kind of concerned that is he praying for some kind of a confrontation? They began to think that the reason why he wants nuclear... Now look at the extrapolation. They said the reason why he wants to learn the nuclear energy cycle and why he wants to learn how to make a nuclear warhead is because he wants to get his imam quicker. This is what the reporter told me. I'm not kidding. Exactly what the reporter told me. He said, what do you have to say about this? Of course, Aghai Ahmadinejad never said this. It's an extrapolation that is made by somebody who doesn't understand the Shia ethos. And therefore, for them, it was a statement of an imminent confrontation between good and evil. Apocalypse. Right? Now, it's a great, great, great distortion. So just imagine, the media, if the media is that literacy level is that low, okay, that means we have a very important role to play in making sure the negative stereotypes about Islam are dispelled. You can't expect them. You know, journalists are not trained to know about Islam. They are not trained to know any religion, by the way. They are quickly sent out on a mission and they are supposed to quickly get a feel of what Islam is all about or what Christianity is all about. And then this is it. They have to write an article. Okay? But I just want to show you how shallow the particular understanding is of somebody who is supposed to report in a prestigious journal, newspaper in America that has certain kind of esteem. And he was prepared to write that this is an indication that we are dealing with somebody who is really irrational. We can't deal with him. His argument was this, that the Americans cannot deal with somebody who is believing in a confrontation. You can't deal with him. Just forget about it and we should just start doing our own business of, you know, what they call this initial attacks, a precursor. Right? But you see how the misunderstanding, but imagine if we had experts in the field of journalism amongst our own. Of course, they would be very much nuanced and sophisticated to know exactly what it means. Right? But I just want to show you how the media at times is deliberate distortion and deliberate misconstrue factual events, and sometimes it is done out of just sheer ignorance. They don't know any better. And they do this also against Christianity, they also do it against Judaism, against Hinduism and Buddhism, and so on. But it shows you the heavy responsibility on our own, on our shoulders that we carry. That whatever we do, whatever we say, on any forum, be very, very, very careful. It is not you alone that you are now speaking. Whatever you say is going to be attributed to Islam. It's a heavy responsibility. Every utterance that we speak out, we are carrying a grave responsibility, and therefore we should be very accountable for our words, including myself, of course. If you saw the video called Fitna, which means sedition, prepared by this member of parliament in Netherlands, I forget his name, a person who has nothing but hate against Islam. You know what he did? He gathered all the clips and images of Muslims when they talk the language of hate, and he pieced them together, and then he made this movie called Al-Fitna, Sedition. And it had large market of views. The viewership was very huge. You won't believe, on the first day he got 1 million hits. Can you imagine? On YouTube. He got 1 million hits on the first day. What he had done is, he pieced together what we say, what you and I we say in many forums. And it, if you look in isolation, it looks like a vicious attack. What he does, he begins with a Quran that it opens up, a Quran, every Quranic verse, and he shows a negative image of Muslims. Another Quranic verse, he's trying to link Quran with violence. The Muslim scripture and bloodshed go together. They're synonymous. Islam is inherently violent. Islam is by nature bloodthirsty religion. That's the connection he's trying to make. He doesn't tell you so. But he wants to show Quran, blood. Quran, violence. Quran, irrationality. And he got these things from our own words. You will say, well, he's cutting them into pieces. So what? We gave him the ammunition. We gave him the ingredients for him to prepare that kind of a very unfair and unjust video. What I want to say is that we are living in a different world. Post September 11th was a seismic event that has changed the dynamics of the globe. You can no longer behave the way we behaved pre-September 11th. It's a new era. And the new era requires new sense of understanding of the complexities. You know, we can no longer function anymore the way we used to behave. Because there are new dynamics at play that demand a new intelligent response that is nuanced and sophisticated. Otherwise, the future looks very bleak. And that's why I say, we need to embrace the language of what Imam Hussein taught us. The language of love, the language of reason, the language of compassion, the language of forgiveness, the language of mutual cooperation, the language of mutual coexistence. The language of inclusion, it's very important. Our vocabulary has to change from the language of exclusion, language of hate, language of animosity, to another paradigm. The paradigm has to change. If the model remains the same, the future looks very bleak for us, because we are completely going to be demonized and dehumanized, as Muslims are those who are this kind of barbaric people. They are the savages. Have you seen, whenever they make films about Islam, they always show the first clip, a camel in a desert. What do camels have to do with Islam now? Doesn't it, I mean, isn't it surprising? Every movie that you see, not every, but majority of the movies, you must see a camel somewhere on the desert. What do we have to do with camels now? We are living in 21st century, post-modernity. The Muslim world, 80% is non-Arabs. And yet the image that we receive is somehow Muslims are Arabs, Muslims are backwards, Muslims are regressive. It's almost like it's a pre-planned tactic. Or normally you will see Muslims always in a state of prostration. They are always in a state of sujood. Why always sujood? There are other things that we do. Right? I mean, it's or you know, women will be shown with kind of, you know, in this veil or burqa and so on. You know, oppression of women, Islam. Violence, Islam. Irrationality, Islam. Language of hate, Islam. Terrorism, Islam. It's a deliberate plan. It is not just haphazardly. If the other side is planning so, in such a sophisticated manner, it requires us to be equally sophisticated. If we continue the same style that we have had, the same kind of rhetoric of rancor and animosity, it doesn't work. I think it is high time for us, not only Sunni and Shia should work together, especially Shia and Shia should learn to work in tandem. It is not feasible. It is really unjust, a disservice to Imam Hussein. If we cannot live together as Shia, believe me, we can't live with each other as brothers and sisters. We have some minor disagreements. Every family has some minor disagreements. That's fine. Disagreements should not be equated to disrespect. Did you know that we have Kutub al-Rijal? When the Sahaba of the Imam used to talk with him, some of his companions would disagree with the Imam. Can you believe that? Al-Qashiz Rijal. Some of his prominent companions, they would engage in a dialogue, in a discourse with the Imam and disagree with the Imam or asking for proofs. Amazing. You would say the Imam should have just disowned them and burned them. Who are you? I'm Masum and I'm the appointee of God and you dare question my proofs and over for you. Jahannam for you. This would be our style, believe me. And yet we are nothing compared to the Imams. We are not even a tiny speck. If you compare with the Imam's grandeur, the Prophet's grandeur, we are not even an iota. And yet we are pumped with arrogance that nobody should disagree with me. It's arrogance. If we don't allow disagreement, that means I'm arrogant. Yes, we have disagreements as brothers and sisters within the Shia community. And I think disagreement is very natural. It's very natural. We should not be monolithic. If everybody agreed, something is wrong, you can be sure. They're being too nice to you. If you go to Iranian gathering, you ask Iranians, is everybody in agreement? They say, yeah. This is just, you know, ta'arufat. This is the etiquette. They always say, but when you leave, that's when they begin. You know, what did he know? Okay. But you know, Khojas, we disagree, and that's good. For example, it breaks my heart to see Mehfil Alihi on one corner, and then we see the Stanmore Mosque on the other side, as if they are supposed to be in a state of confrontation, or at least they are not supposed to see eye to eye. Well, so what? So what? There's no big news, big revelation. People disagree. But the real test is of our maturity, if we are mature. Right now we are in the state of infancy. A person who is infantile cannot... Have you seen kids? They can't disagree and it's over. They start crying and jumping and they have these temper tantrums, right? But a sign of maturity, sophistication is one can disagree and still be very respectful. This is what we call a mature community that is progressively growing. But the moment we say no, because you disagreed, it's now we break our linkage, it shows lack of maturity. Don't you think? The ethos of disagreement does not mean that we are enemies, it just means we disagree. It's perfectly fine. And I think Imam Hussein's message is to cultivate the culture, the ethos of safety. Everybody should feel safe. Everybody should feel safe to speak their mind. You know, every point the Imam went, in Tha'labiyya, in Zubala, Batna Aqiq, he always told them everything. He said, this has happened now. This news has come from about Muslim Ibn Aqil. This news has come about, you know, Qais bin Mushir. And so on. and say, it's your choice. You can stay with me. You can leave me. It wasn't by force. It was by love. People who stayed with him, they stayed with him wholeheartedly because of love. And I think it's very, very important, I believe, that in this post-September 11th, these kind of disagreements should not create any kind of disparity or this rupture. It's a disservice, a disservice. A disservice to Islam and a disservice to Imam Hussein's message. Salawat. Yesterday we talked about the seven aspects or the seven dimensions of religion. That if you want to find that point of, or at least the vicinity of moderation, we have to make sure that all these elements are within our worldview and they are in proportionate amount, in proper proportion. We don't want to have anything in excess or anything in shortfall. That's the recipe for either extremism on one side or deficiency. And the components are very quickly. One is the ritual component, prayers. Very important. Very, very, very important. That's why we say it's Umud al-Din, a pillar of religion. Prayers is very important as a ritual. It unites us. It gives us a sense of this dialogue with God is ongoing. The communion with God is ongoing. We don't stop our conversation with God. It's all the time. One of the biggest sins in Christianity is what we call the original sin, right? The original sin of the whatever the infraction was between Adam and Eve. Isn't it true? And then we have inherited in Christianity, I'm talking about. In Islam, one can say one of the major sins is ghafla, forgetfulness of God. And that's why for the Sufis, for the mystics, it's very important for them to recite dhikr. Because they don't want to be guilty of this sin, this very mortal sin to forget God. And God says, if you forget me, you will forget yourself. It's a promise. That is, it's a mortal sin. And therefore, the Sufis will recite dhikr. They want to be in a state of ongoing remembrance of God. So, prayers is important. It's a five, or we do it three times, okay, fine, that's fine too, you know. But it's supposed to be five. You can separate them. There's more thawab, of course. This fadila is more. But you can still do it three times. Anyways, it's supposed to periodically remind us that, listen, your orientation should be towards God. Do not be deflected away from God. One should do it. It's highly spiritual exercise as well. There's an emotional component. We said the experiential component is also very important that we should also have. For example, in the Muharram program, we have things like, for example, Marsiya, Noha, Matam, all wonderful. Doesn't mean that everybody has to do Matam exactly the way it was done by a particular culture. Arabs do different kinds of Matam, Iranians do different kinds. It's your way of expression of grief. The only important thing is your expression of sorrow and grief. But how you actualize it, in what format, perfectly fine. In the pre-Islamic era, the culture of Jahiliyyah, they also had a very strong emotional component. What was so emotional about the Arabs? Talking about the pre-Islamic Arabia, those that we call the era of Jahiliyyah. What was so emotional about them? That was imbalanced. And the Prophet came to balance it. I'm waiting. I know many names now, by the way, you know. What about the one who read this, sister? You read so beautifully about Hur, you know, Sister Manji, right? Muhammad's sister? No? Are you Muhammad? Muhammad was yesterday, right? What? Muhammad Walji, was it? Muhammad Manji, right? Sorry? Oh, no, sorry, the day before was Muhammad. And are you his sister? Yes? Okay. Help her. What was so excessive or extremist about, yes, pre-Islamic, yes? Yes, exactly. Asabiyya. Ta'assub. A sense of tribal humanism. That my tribe has some kind of superiority over yours. nationalistic pride about their own tribal origin, their tribal lineage, and other tribes are open game. They had a very excessive kind of self-absorption about their own tribes and tribal values. And therefore, if you kill somebody from my tribe, I will have a continuous feud against you until I get somebody from your side. And there was this ongoing fratricidal war just because of asabiyya, the sense of, you know, tribalism. The Prophet knew this emotion is very dysfunctional. It is very unhealthy. It is very dangerous. The Prophet came and he channeled this emotion in moderation towards something very constructive. He said, okay, loyalty is good. Loyalty is good, but loyalty not to your tribe, but loyalty to the message of God. Loyalty to your fellow people who agree with you in the belief system. Loyalty to the Ummah. So the emotion part was there, the emotional part. Love for the tribe was still there. He just oriented this concept of love towards love for the appreciation of the kingdom of God, people of God. You see, it became into a concept of Ummah, not anymore tribe or Qabila, but right now the concept became love for the Ummah. The same concept, isn't it true? He just balanced it. Something was dysfunctional to something very constructive. Talk about the generosity, the Arab karama, generosity. They were excessively generous to the extent they would become penniless because they want to be very generous to you. The Prophet said, no, you got to balance. No, there is no extremism within Islam. Al-wasat. You should not be excessively generous at the same time, don't be excessively stingy. But find a point of moderation in which the Quran says, don't stretch your hands forth so openly. At the same time, don't chain them to your neck. But rather be in moderation. I'm trying to show you that Islam is all about non-extremism, non-exaggeration, and non-fanaticism. That's the point we want to make. Anything you touch on Islam, Islam tries to show you and direct you. And the Prophet did this in all these rituals of the Arabs. Wherever there was excessiveness, he tried to moderate them and channel the energy towards constructive reform. Likewise, we have a lot of energy in Muharram. A lot of energy is generated, and rightly so. Just we want to channel the energy towards constructive reform and change for the betterment for us individually and also for the community. Salawat. And by the way, it's very important for me to just say as an aside, the Arab culture, when we say Jahiliyyah, it doesn't mean they were illiterate, by the way, you know. It's very wrong. It doesn't mean that they were barbarians. It doesn't mean they were savages. Jahiliyyah does not mean. It also doesn't mean that they are ignorant in terms of intellectually. Scholars have discovered recent evidence through archaeological excavation and finding of some literature that the Arabs are very literate. The Arabs are highly cultured. In that pre-Islamic Arabia of 7th century, we have evidence to prove that the Arabs at that time were highly cultured people. They were not just nomadic Arabs, but they were also agriculturalists. They were also living in sedentary lifestyle. They were not just nomads going from one place to the other and just having a fight all the time. That's how you say, right? They would go and invade those caravans and loot and then run away. No. It did happen occasionally at times, because that was the concept of protection in those days. Not just the Arabs, it was a custom. War was the norm in those days, unless you have some kind of security, you're open for attack. So you have to have security. War was the default in those times. Not just in the Arabian Peninsula, everywhere. That was the default position. So yes, there were these instances as well, but the Prophet restrained them. But the Arabs were not, you know, bloodthirsty savages. It's very wrong in scholarship. And many a times you will see this repeated, especially post-September 11, to demonize the Arabs or Islam, that they were so backward, they are so regressive, and they were savages. Absolutely untrue. Why do we say so? Because we know for a fact that the Arab literature was on a very high level, very high scale. The oratory, the eloquence, we know, was very high. As a matter of fact, they used to have this competition. Many competitions in which they would compete in terms of the eloquence of Arabic poetry. So it's a literate community, maybe not writing, but certainly in the oral transmission. The other evidence that we have is this, that Saudi Mecca in that era was at a midpoint. It was at a crossroad between the Sassanid Empire on the north, northeast, right, and the Byzantine, which is northwest. Two major empires with high cultures. And then you have the Yemenis, Yemeni culture in the south, with the Ghassanids and Lakhmids. Very high culture. And we know for a fact, it's not something new revelation, we knew for a fact the Yemeni culture was a high culture. And all these caravans, they used to pass through Mecca, because Mecca was a center for worship, for Mecca. It was also a center of these merchant trades. So imagine if you have all this kind of human traffic going on from different cultures, you don't think it rubs off on the Arabs? It just remains. Jahiliyyah does not mean this. What do you think Jahiliyyah means? It means spiritually they were Jahil, spiritual malaise. It means spiritually they had lost their moral compass, their ethical compass. For example, they were highly consumeristic. They were highly individualistic. They only cared about themselves or their tribes and nobody else. They were highly pessimistic. That is to say, for those Arabs in Jahiliyyah, the concept of time was very pessimistic, the concept of life. They thought only the time is here. Once we die, it's over. And therefore, we should just have fun. We should just enjoy our life, because after life, there's nothing. Ad-dahar, the Quran says. The Arabs say, there's nothing in life but time. So they were Jahil in terms of spiritually, in terms of these other concepts, morally and ethically and so on, but not in the sense of illiteracy or culture. They were highly cultured people and high civilization as well. Salawat. If you have Arabs in the community, you owe me. Isn't it how you have learned? I mean, you know, the Arabs are Jahil. You know, that's not true at all. That's not true at all. We also have the component of narrative, we said. That is to say, a historical sacred narrative that you can connect with in your stories. Narratives and stories is a good way of teaching morals and ethics to kids. Did you know? There's a book written by some of these, you know, those who are in parenting. Is that when you teach, when you tell stories to your children and you have a moral in the story, moral, it's the best way of teaching morality. It's not by prescription. You don't tell the kid, this is the way it's going to be. But rather you teach him through narratives, stories. And then you allow him to figure out his own moral conclusion. It's called a moral dilemma analysis process. That he figures it out. If he doesn't figure out, of course you guide him. But you don't dictate to him how he should believe. Of course at different ages. When they are young, of course teach them. I'm talking about, you know, when they become mature like Miqdad and Ammar and Kumail and on the sister side as well. That's when you start to reason with them. We have the component of, or earlier, because they challenge you even earlier, right? My kids are very young. It's very easy for me right now. So I don't know when they'll be challenging me. The component of the doctrinal, the intellectual part of understanding the theology, the philosophy, the mystical side, the ethical side, the legal side, very quickly the social side, and the material side, which is calligraphy, we say things like, you know, architecture, minaret, and so on. These are all part and parcel of making the entirety of religion. You move away from any of this in excess, you become what we call an extremist. For example, today we can take an example that today we have drifted into the realm of law. What about theology? What about philosophy, falsafa? What about irfan, mysticism, Sufism? What about history, tariq? What about understanding the political ethos of the time? All these things are not so. What about sociology? What about anthropology? It makes no difference in understanding Islam, you think? It makes a big difference. Sociology of religion, philosophy of ethics, you know, it's very important to understand Islam. And therefore, we have drifted into the realm of strictly law. Law is good. Islamic law is good. Fiqh is good. Usul al-fiqh is good. But when you go excessively on one side and you overgrow on one side, that's what we call a phenomena of exaggeration or extremism. Salawat. Very quickly. So we need certain components. And I want to move very fast now. We want to have, for example, Quran. We want to have Hadith. We want to have politics, understanding of political, socio-political environment in the Hijaz and post-Hijaz. We want to understand theology. We want to understand philosophy. We want to understand history. We want to understand jurisprudence. We want to understand mysticism, anthropology, sociology, and so on. These are all interrelated. They have an impact. Okay, all of them, and etc. All these disciplines have some kind of a relationship with our understanding of the religious phenomena. Let's begin with the Quran, for example. The Quran is a living document. Do you agree? The Quran is not a dead. It's like a living organism. Do you agree? We agree. Quran did not die in the 7th century, right? Quran is supposed to be a living book, an organic book, that talks and interacts with me and with society. The Quran itself calls itself a living book. How? In one of the hadiths it says, Al-Quranu hayyun la yamut. The Quran is alive, it will never perish, it will never die. So if it's supposed to be a living creature, a living organism, a living document, that means that there's an interplay. It is not a one way, but rather I'm also interacting with the Quran is also guiding me. It's both ways. It's a dialectic process. But if I regard the Quran as a frozen book, as a book that is a fossilized book, a book that came to dormancy and stagnancy in the 7th century with the completion of revelation, it has no relevance. It's no more a living organism. Yes, I can open the Quran when somebody dies. Yes, I can open the Quran, when I have an exam. Yeah, especially law exam, medicine exam. One of the brothers has a law medicine exam coming up very soon. Let's open the Quran, why not? It's a dead book. Why not open the Quran when we have istikhara? Istikhara, there was one person who had taken a big amount of loan. And he said, whenever I take out the istikhara, it says, don't pay him. What does istikhara have to do with paying? You have to fulfill your debts. Istikhara is in a situation where you are indecisive. You can't make up your mind. And you're 50-50. You have done all your mental research. And after exhausting your mental capability, you are in a deadlock. Well, istikhara is good. Certainly God guides. مَا خَابَ مَنْ istikhara, says the hadith. It will guide us. But of course, in the proper circumstances. Now somebody wants to get married and say istikhara. Somebody called me actually for istikhara. And they wanted to get married. But they were, when they love each other a lot? Huh? Sorry? They're in love. What do you say? There's a youngster's term. I forget these things. I want to sound like I am, in tune with the language, Anyways, they were in, sorry? Ah, they were in, good. You see, exactly what I want. They were infatuated with each other. You see? You ask a youngster, he knows. They were so much in love with each other and they said, okay, let's do istikhara. Well, they know each other. They know each other's families. They love each other. They are compatible economically, worldview, socially, everything. They see eye to eye. The families love each other. They know each other for many, many years. Istikhara. And I told them, are you aware of the implications of istikhara? And they said, yes, everything is good. We are happy. But still, we want to know. I said, there can be implications for you. We want to see what God says. Istikhara came very bad. Not very, very bad, but anyways, on the side of negative, not completely horrific, but certainly negative, it wasn't as positive. I told them. Now they're very upset with me. What do I have to do with the istikhara? You asked me. You forced me. Of course, they weren't upset. They were upset with the result. They said, okay, can you do another one? What's the point? If you think it's just a game, okay, don't do it then. But the idea was that I should do it as many times as necessary to get a one, affirmative one, and then they will say, okay, you see, God wants, that's a mockery of istikhara. Istikhara means you are prepared to fulfill the outcome. It doesn't mean you can't do it. It's not haram. For example, istakhara says bad. Don't do it. Should I enter this business or not? Istakhara says very bad. And you still do it. It doesn't mean it's guna. There's no sin. There's no sin at all. You still do it, if you so decide. It just means that you have been forewarned that there are some negative consequences here. But it doesn't mean that it's a sin. Likewise, if something comes positive and you don't do it, there is no sin in it. It just means that you have lost an opportunity, a good opportunity. Right? In any event, so we use the Quran for istakhara. What else can we use istakhara? Somebody's born. Yeah, let's read Quran in his ears, you know. Somebody dies. Somebody has put a jinx on me. We have this hariza. Do you make this hariza? You can charge big bucks, I'm told. Did you know? One guy, this is just a story, it's just a joke. Somebody came and said, you know, make for me a hariza. You know, what do you want the hariza for? He says, I want that couple to be separated. He said, okay, how fast do you want them to be separated and how miserable do you want them to be? Depending upon how miserable, my price goes up. If you want him to lose one of his eyes as well, the price goes even higher. I mean, this is a mockery, you know, right? For hariza. Of course, we have hariza, the concept of. What else can we use the Quran? That's like a dead text. Examples. Brothers, wow, you guys are very quiet. I think the rowdy crowd got stuck in the snow. No? Oh, yeah. Sure. And I think that's the proper way. When I was in the office of one of the Maharaja, there's a special telephone and a scholar, a religious scholar of very high caliber, just sitting there and receiving telephone calls, literally. He would just say, Salam, Bale. I said, Sabkon, I mean, wait. Bade. Okay. Salam, Bale. Sabkon. Khube. It's good. And literally, I'm not kidding. I mean, the telephone line just for this. Huh? A hotline. I told him, if you just charge, you know, 25 cents or 25 pence, you're a multimillionaire. We don't need homes anymore. It's over. I mean, you get the message. Is that we should read the Quran as a living document, as a living text, because the Quran was a living document for the community. How the Quran was revealed over a course of 23 years. It was interacting with the community. Something would happen, an issue comes up, and they ask the Prophet, how do we resolve it? A revelation comes. That means the Quran was supposed to be a very active, played a very active role in formulating the entire community ethos. For us, what we have to do is, we have to go and find the occasion of Asbab al-Nuzul, and then we have to try to extract what is the principle in this particular revelation. That's the key. What is the principle or the efficacious cause for this revelation? Once you know the efficacious cause and the principle of the revelation, then you say, can I now make a generalization about this principle? And if you can generalize the principle, now you can apply those principles in different scenarios. That's where the Quran becomes a living text, a dynamic text, a text that is talking with us. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. The hadith the same. The hadith needs to be contextualized. There's a particular socio-historical context with which the hadith came. For example, if I tell you a hadith in which, do you believe or not? There's a hadith which says that the Prophet told the community, he told the men, that if I were to ask anyone in the world to prostrate to anybody else besides God, I would have asked the wives of the husbands to do sajda and to prostrate to their husbands. You think it's literal? First of all, do you think it's even the Prophet said so? It's commonly known. Do you think the Prophet would say this? He would say that, listen, you have to revere and respect your husband so much that if I had a choice of asking you to worship somebody and bow down to anybody else except God, I would have asked you to bow down because the husband deserves that kind of reverence and respect. Do you think it's true? No? Yes? How many think it's true? Let's see a show of hands in the men's side. How many think it's true? How many think it's false? Okay. How many are just, they're not sure? Okay, how many say it's true? How many say it's false? How many say, I don't know, it could go either way? Okay. Stay tuned for the answer. It's coming on gender power. We'll talk about this issue, inshallah ta'ala, salawat. Anyways, let me pause here. The Quran is a document that is supposed to speak to us in every age. We say the Quran is a miraculous document because it is a living book, a living creature, a living organism, and it has to speak to us. If you gather all the Quranic verses on law, there are no more than 1/10 of the Quran is on law. If you gather everything, economic issues, ritual issues, worship, social issues, law of inheritance, law of qisas, law of penal provisions, you collect all these legal verses, international law, it is no more than 1/10 of the Holy Quran. Only 10%. Maximum. The other 90% is something quite different. Well, if that is the case, then it only requires for us to again reevaluate the weight that we give. You know, 90% is all about ethics, morality, spirituality, kindness, compassion, and so on. Salawat. Let's have questions.
We'll begin from the ladies' side. Is there any questions?
The ladies' side? And I'm sorry I'm keeping you over time. You know, I've tried so hard to keep my... But I always, you know, go over time. And I do apologize. That's very unfair to you. Especially on a weekday. Somebody said, put a hot plate. One of my friends, should be a hot plate here. The time expires, it starts getting warmer and warmer. Yes, sister. No questions?
Uncle.
Yes?
Assalamu alaikum, Brother Hamid.
Alaikum salam.
Thank you very much indeed for your lecture. You'll be very gratified to know, this is just a comment and not a question, you'll be very gratified to know that the relationship between Stanmore and this organization is very, very cordial indeed. It's based on mutual respect. We cooperate with each other on every level, and it's not as it's sometimes portrayed by people outside these two communities as how the relationships are on every level.
That's wonderful.
It's recognized that they meet the needs of different people in different ways, but that just celebrates our diversity and doesn't put any barriers between us. So I just wanted to make that clear.
That's wonderful news, because I think the general opinion outside, I don't know the inner dynamics here, of course, but the general, you know, opinions are that they are on polarized ends. But this is wonderful, wonderful news to hear that they have this very cordial and loving and brotherly and sisterly relation, and they work together in partnership for projects. I think it's great. And it should not just be outward courtesy. One should truly believe, like we as Mehfil Ali should truly believe, that each and every individual at the Stanmore Mosque is worthy of full respect and full dignity. Not just courtesy, you know, okay, just to be good, you know, mushy, what do you say? But really to believe, you know, from the bottom of our heart, they're worthy of every respect. Yes, they can disagree, so what? And likewise, vice versa, reciprocally. They should also believe from the bottom of their heart that we are worthy of the same kind of dignity and respect that God has given all of us, without exception. You know, but if you see here, you know, some of the places you sit down and over tea and samosa and you say, all this, what is this nonsense? Right? We do this, begin gossiping and talking. And anyways, I don't know how lively it is here because I haven't had samosas and with this kind of...
But you'll find that at every level, people will integrate and people take positions of responsibility across both organizations, the same individual will necessarily take that kind of action. And whether it's with the seniors of our communities or whether it's within the youth,
right,
or at any age level, there is that integration, so rest assured.
That's wonderful news. You know, that is certainly very wonderful news. This lesson of, it shows then we are becoming mature. I don't think we are in that infantile phase anymore. We are becoming baligh. I don't know, have you become baligh yet? I think so then. If we can live cordially, I think we have attained at least bulugh. Thank you very much for this clarification. I appreciate it.
Any questions on the lady side? Hello, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam.
A lot of what you're talking about in terms of extremism on both sides is obviously very important, and it's very important to find the middle. But extremism differs substantially depending on where you are in your context. In the UK, it's extremist to believe that homosexuals should not get married. Amongst the scholars, it's probably extremist to believe that you shouldn't, among some group of scholars, it's extremist to believe that you shouldn't curse any of the Khalis. I mean, extremism works in every single way. What is the yardstick? And I know we'll say the Quran, but how is it possible to actually make that distinction on different topics?
Very good question. You see, yes, indeed, you know, although we say we use these kinds of terminology, but it lacks precision and clarity. For example, I very often use the word rationality. And then one of the sisters caught me. I think it was Khadija, was it? You know, I use terminology like moderation, point of balance, extremism, exaggeration, and so on. But they, of course, they have a sense of ambiguity. They are not as conceptually precise. Okay. And that I acknowledge. But now that you brought the issue, I think it's very important to say that these categories that we put them are not so precise. So, for example, rationalism, when we say, is a concept of 17th, 18th century of Enlightenment era, it means a very different thing. If you want to apply the concept of rationality in pre-modern era, well, you have to be careful how you apply it. Because rationality in 18th century meant something quite unique. Just like you say fundamentalism, it meant something very different in the Protestant fundamentalist movement. Okay? So you are right, we have this issue. But when I say, you know, to answer as best as I can, when we talk about extremism, we want to use the Quran, like you said, as the arbiter. When the Quran says that we have made you the best community. كُنْتُمْ خَيْرَ أُمَّةٍ أُخْرِجَتْ لِلنَّاسِ. We have made you the best community. Doesn't mean us necessarily. It means in terms of whoever has the characteristics. تَعْمُرُونَ بِالْمَعْرُوفِ وَتَنْحَوْنَ عَنِ الْمُنْكَرِ. You do amr bil-ma'roof and nahi al-munkar. That means extremism gets away when we have this mutual dialectic tension. When we do each other amr bil-ma'roof and nahi anil munkar, It's a self-corrective process that should lead us to the point of moderation, away from the extremities. But if there is no this dialectics going on, there is no exchange, there's no dialogue, it's a one-way avenue, right? Then there's the danger of extremism. Exactly what we see in the Wahhabi culture, exactly what we see in many other sects of Islam too. We have issues of extremism too. We have issues of exaggeration too. Ghuluf. You know, it's not just pointing fingers at others. Sunnis have issues too. It is because of, you know, like the Imam Ali said, if you give this away, amr bil ma'roof and nahi munkar, you're going to suffer terribly. For you wali shirarukum, those who are the mischievous one will rule over you. Look at our countries. We have dictators. We haven't inculcated the virtue of dialectics. It's a virtue. It's a virtue. Just like exactly the way it was said by this brother, that, you know, we celebrate diversity. Diversity is good. Exactly. That's exactly the way it should be treated, is that there is no harm. And the moment we begin to operationalize this concept, because the Quran says you are the best community if you do this, That means there is mutual reciprocity. Or the Quranic verse that says, وَكَذَلِكَ جَعَلْنَاكُمْ أُمَّةً وَسَطًا. We have made you a community, al-wasat. Al-wasat means you are on point of moderation, al-wasat. Neither on this side or the other side. Well, of course, we can never be exactly on the point of al-wasat because we are not ma'soom. But we have a kind of a radius, let's say, a safe radius. I don't know how many miles. But there is a kind of a safe radius within which if we can operate, well, it's perfectly fine. Inshallah wa ta'ala, God will overlook our mistakes. But to expect everyone to be on the point of al-wasat, and then to say, I know the point of al-wasat, and what I say as a human being is the point of al-wasat, this is where you bring about extremism. Rather, I should say that, you know, this is my best endeavor, my best exertion is that, you know, al-wasat is somewhere in this area, but I can be also corrected through the process of amr bil ma'ruf. It's a self-corrective mechanism. If it is a one way, we will have and will continue to have extremism phenomena, and we do this, we create cults. We create cults. Did you know? Somebody becomes a hero for us, and now we have to make him almost like a cultish figure. Now nothing can be done, it's over. When the cultish figure says anything, it goes, because we made a cult out of it. We made idols. They themselves never claim to be idols. They say we are human beings. We make errors. We are fallible human beings. We do our research, but we are not infallible. Well, we made them into idols. Then the outcome is, of course, what we see today, the phenomena of extremism and lack of... You see, because if it is a one-way street, we never learn how to disagree. You see, we never learn how to disagree. Because the culture is not there. The culture is the command comes and you just move on like a soldier. Well, we don't know how to disagree. You know. But that is... I don't think I can answer the question, but I just want to give you at least a way of how I would try to answer the question. Okay? But you know, the question is very relevant, and you should ask people when they use these big words like rationality and extremism and I don't know, epistemology, ask them, what do you mean? Now, you caught me, but otherwise I would have gone scot-free. But okay, that's fine. And the first person who caught me was Khadija. Was it Khadija? Yeah, she caught me in that meeting that we had a couple of days ago. They gave me very delicious food at Versi, what's his first name? Not Riaz, not Ahmad. What's the other? Murtaza. Murtaza and his wife had prepared for us a sumptuous, delicious meal. Oh, it was so delicious and amazing and variety. Once they had fed me properly, they said, okay, start questions and conversation. That's the price. It was a very interesting discussion, by the way. The sisters were so intelligent and so were the brothers. Move on.
Yeah.
Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. As I begin the Masaib, I really want to remember an eminent jurist who passed away yesterday and who was buried just today. The marhum Ayatullah al-Uzma Hussein Ali Muntazari, may God bless his soul and give him a place in paradise in close proximity to the Masumin, inshallah wa ta'ala. And if you get a chance, do offer prayer for him, namaz-e-wahshat, I think, inshallah wa ta'ala, may God accept. We have a hadith in Al-Kafi which says, whenever a scholar dies, fulima fil Islam fulmatan la yasudduha shay. Whenever a scholar dies, he creates a crack or he creates a fissure of such an extent that nothing can repair it. So scholarship is highly praised. Agreement, disagreement is another issue. We have to respect scholars. لِأَنَّ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ الْفُقَهَا حُسْنُ الْإِسْلَامِ كَحُسْنِ سُورِ الْمَدِينَةِ لَهَا. Because the scholars of Islam, the mu'mineen, the believers, are like the fortress of Islam. Just like the fortress around a city. They give us a sense of insulation, a kind of protection. And therefore, I think it's very important to remember this great scholar, May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala bless his soul. And we recite, رَحِمَ اللَّهُ مَنْ يَكْرَهُ الْفَاتِحَ. Imam Hussein is on his way with the intention to arrive at Kufa. In the process, he is digressed and he goes to different points. He reaches a point called Sifah and he meets a port called Farazdak. And he says, what's the situation of Kufa? He said, well, their hearts are with you, but their swords are against you. He goes to Thalabiyya. He receives the news of the execution of Muslim ibn Aqil and Hani ibn Urwa. And he informs everybody there. He arrives in Zubala and he's informed that Qais bin Mushir was taken at Al-Qadisiyah and he was then killed as well. Imam Hussein informs the people. He goes to the point of Batn al-Atiq and then he realizes that there is an army that has been sent by Ubaidillah ibn Ziyad under the headship of Hur. And they're coming towards Imam Hussein. He takes the course of towards Dhu Husum. When he arrives there, he sees the number of soldiers are coming from the other side and he asks his people to encamp there, put up their camps and prepare for this troops who are coming. The army of Hur, when they arrive, they are suffering from acute thirst. And Imam Hussein and his entourage had full control over the water supply. And many of the companions of the Imam Hussein, they told him that this is our best opportunity to fight against them in this moment of weakness when they are thirsty. And therefore, there is no better opportunity than now. Al-Imam Al-Hussein, like I said, is not a man who calculates power. He's not after power dynamics. He's a man who wants to shake human conscience. Big difference. Muawiyah said when he made the treaty with Imam Hassan, he told the Syrians, I did not fight Imam Ali because I wanted for you to pray or to give zakat or for you to fast. You do all that. I fought Imam Ali, Ali ibn Abi Talib, because I wanted power over you. Imam Hussein is on a different kind of a moral platform. He says, no, this cannot be done. You have to supply water supply to them, to their needs. And not only this, the Imam said that he will also participate in providing water to the enemy forces of Hur. Time for prayer comes, and surprisingly, both the side of Hur and the side of Imam Hussein, they pray behind Imam Hussein. It shows you the great contradiction in the minds of people. The soldiers of Hur, they are still praying behind the same Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet. And Hur himself is praying behind Imam Hussein. At the same time, they are prepared to fight against him and shed his blood. It shows a sense of moral paradox. They were morally confused, ethically confused. And that's exactly the need for Imam Hussein's revolution, to bring about that moral compass of morally wrong and morally right, because people's conscience had become so dull. The Imam tells Hur that I'm going to progress towards Kufa. And he says, no. He says, let's make a compromise and we'll go neither towards Kufa nor towards any other place, towards Mecca, but go in between. And they do so and they begin the journey. And this is the same Hur. I want to remember Hur today. This is the same Hur whose conscience was reawakened by the sermons that Imam Hussein gave and by the various reasoning arguments that Imam Hussein made by love and compassion to Hur, that on that day of Ashura, on the 10th day, we are told that Hur himself is having second thoughts and he begins to shiver, says one of the riwayah, like a leaf. And one of the companions from the same tribe, Muhajir ibn Aus, when he sees Hur, he says, "What has happened to you? If somebody had asked me about you, I would have said you are one of the most courageous people from the tribe, from the Arabs. But your behavior today shows to me something is wrong with you." And Hur says, "Something has happened. His moral conscience has become alive." He says, "I can see clearly my destiny between virtue and vice, between hellfire and damnation. This is precisely the purpose of Imam Hussein, to bring about this revolution within human conscience, human hearts, to bring about a radical change towards becoming morally sound human being." Hur takes a chance and gallops on the other side and says, Abu Mikhnaf, فَنَزَلْ حُرْ أَنْ ظَهْرِ جَوَادِهِ وَتَعْتَى رَحْسَهُ وَجَعَلَ يُقَبِّلُ يَدِ الْحُسَيْنِ وَرِجْلَيْهِ وَهُوَ يَبْقَى بُقَاءً شَدِيدًا. He moves towards Imam Hussein and kisses his hand and his feet, and he begins to cry profusely. فَقَالَ لَهُ الْحُسَيْنِ إِرْفَعَ رَأْسَكَ يَا شَيْخ. Imam Hussein tells him in a very respectful language, he says, "O Shaykh, lift up your head." فَرَفَعَ رَأْسَهُ وَقَالَ يَا مَوْلَايَ أَنَا الَّذِي مَنَعْتُكَ أَنِ الرُّجُوعِ وَاللَّهِ يَا مَوْلَايَ مَا عَلِمْتُ أَنَّ الْقَوْمَ يَبْلِغُونَ مِنْكَ هَذَا. He says, "O Imam, I was the one who prevented you. I was the one who prevented you from returning back to Mecca. By God, my master, I had no knowledge that this community will behave with you the way they have. وَقَدْ جِئْتُكَ نَائِبًا مِمَّا كَانَ مِنِّي وَمُوَاسِيكَ بِنَفْسِي وَقَلِيلٌ فِي حَقِّكَ يَا مَوْلَايَ أَن تَكُونَ نَفْسِي لَكَ الْفِدَاءَ. He says, "Imam, I have now come to you in repentance, seeking your forgiveness. And I offer myself and my soul to you to sacrifice in your cause." And he says, فَحَلْ مِن تَوْبَةٍ عِنْدَكَ رَبِّي فَقَالَ لَهُ إِن تُبْتُ تَابَ اللَّهُ عَلَيْكَ وَيَغْفِرُ لَكَ وَهُوَ أَرْحَمُ الرَّاحِمِينَ. He says, "Inshallah, if your repentance will be accepted, inshallah wa ta'ala, by God, He is most forgiving and most compassionate." He asks Imam Hussein for permission to go on the battlefield. And he does so, and he fights very bravely. And finally, when he falls, he gives out the call to his master Imam Hussein to let him know that he has fallen down and to recover in his body. And look at the barbarity and the savagery of the other forces. Where is the Islam? Offering prayers, offering 5 daily prayers, fasting. At the same time, they have no qualms in this barbarity, savagery, killing a human being and chopping off his head, and they threw his head. وَاحْتَزُوا رَأْسَهُ وَرَمُوا بِهِ إِلَى الْحُسَيْنِ. They threw his head towards Imam Hussein. فَأَخَذَهُ الْحُسَيْنِ وَجَعَلَ يَمْسَحُ الدَّمَ أَنْ وَجْهِ وَثَنَايَا وَيَقُولُ وَاللَّهِ مَا أَخْتَعَتْ أُمُّكَ حَيْثُ سَمَّتْكَ حُرًّا وَاللَّهُ إِنَّكَ حُرًّا فِي الدُّنْيَا وَسَعِيدٌ فِي الْآخِرَةِ. The Imam removes the blood from the face of Al-Hur, begins to praise him, begins to eulogize him, begins to recite poetry in his praise. And he says to Hur, "Wallahi, by God, your mother made no mistake when she named you Hur, because you are free, you are independent, both in this life and you are prosperous in the life hereafter." فَسَيَعْلَمُ الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا أَيَّ مُنْكَلِمِيًّا كَلِبُونَ.